And it is no vampire, this thing. It is the very personification of the heavens. And we rise up and up into the stars with it. We go past the angels and the saints, past illumination itself, and into the divine darkness, into the void, as we pass out of existence. In oblivion we are forgiven all things. The destruction of Nicky becomes a tiny pinpoint of vanishing light. The death of my brothers disintegrates into the great peace of the inevitable. I pushed at the soil. I kicked at it, but my hands and legs were too weak. I tasted the sandy mud in my mouth. I knew I had to rise, and the sound was telling me to rise. I felt it again like the roar of artillery, the cannon boom. And quite completely, I understood that it was looking for me, this sound. It was seeking me out. It was searching like a beam of light. I couldn't lie here any more. I had to answer. I sent it the wildest current of welcome. I told it I was here. And I heard my own miserable breaths as I struggled to move my lips. And the sound grew so loud that it was pulsing through every fiber of me. The earth was moving with it around me. Whatever it was, it had come into the burnt-out, ruined house. The door had been broken away, as if the hinges had been anchored not in iron but in plaster. I saw all this against the backdrop of my closed eyes. I saw it moving under the olive trees. It was in the garden. In a frenzy again, I clawed towards the air, but the low, common noise I heard now was of a digging through the sand from above. I felt something soft like velvet brush my face, and I saw overhead the gleam of the dark sky and the drift of the clouds like a veil over the stars, and never had the heavens in all their simplicity looked so blessed. My lungs filled with air. I let out a loud moan at the pleasure of it. But all these sensations were beyond pleasure. To breathe, to see light, these were miracles. And the drumming sound, the great deafening boom, seemed the perfect accompaniment. And he, the one who had been looking for me, the one from whom the sound came, was standing over me. The sound melted. It disintegrated until it was no more than the after-sound of a violin string. And I was rising, just as if I were being lifted up out of the earth, though this figure stood with its hands at its side. At last it lifted its arms to enfold me, and the face I saw was beyond the realm of possibility. What one of us could have such a face? What did we know of patience, of seeming goodness, of compassion? No, it wasn't one of us. It couldn't have been. And yet it was. Preternatural flesh and blood, like mine. Iridescent eyes, gathering the light from all directions, tiny eyelashes like strokes of gold from the finest pen. And this creature, this powerful vampire, was holding me upright and looking into my eyes, and I believe that I said some mad thing, voiced some frantic thought, that I knew now the secret of eternity. "Then tell it to me," he whispered, and he smiled, the purest image of human love. "Oh God, help me! Damn me to the pit of hell!" This was my voice speaking. "I can't look on this beauty." I saw my arms like bones, hands like birds' talons. Nothing can live and be what I am now, this wraith. I looked down at my legs. They were sticks. The clothing was falling off me. I couldn't stand or move, and the remembered sensation of blood flowing in my mouth suddenly overcame me. Like a dull blaze before me, I saw his red velvet clothes, the cloak that covered him to the ground, the dark red-gloved hands with which he held me. His hair was thick, white and gold strands mingled in waves, fallen loosely around his face and over his broad forehead, and the blue eyes might have been brooding under their heavy golden brows had they not been so large, so softened with the feeling expressed in the voice. A man in the prime of life at the moment of the immortal gift, and a square face, with its slightly hollowed cheeks, its long full mouth, stamped with terrifying gentleness and peace. "Drink," he said, eyebrows rising slightly, lips shaping the word carefully, slowly, as if it were a kiss. As Magnus had done on that lethal night so many eons ago, he raised his hand now and moved the cloth back from his throat. The vein, dark purple, beneath the translucent, preternatural skin offered itself, and the sound commenced again, that overpowering sound, and it lifted me right off the earth and drew me into it. Blood like light itself. Liquid fire. Our blood. And my arms gathering incalculable strength, winding round his shoulders, my face pressed to his cool white flesh, the blood shooting down into my loins and every vessel in my body ignited with it. How many centuries had purified this blood, distilled its power? It seemed beneath the roar of the flow he spoke. He said again, "Drink, my young one, my wounded one." I felt his heart swell, his body undulate, and we were sealed against each other. I think I heard myself say, "Marios." And he answered, "Yes." Part 7. Ancient Magic, Ancient Mysteries. 1. When I awoke, I was on board a ship. I could hear the creak of the boards, smell the sea. I could smell the blood of those who manned the ship, and I knew that it was a galley because I could hear the rhythm of the oars under the low rumbling of the giant canvas sails. I couldn't open my eyes, couldn't make my limbs move. Yet I was calm. I didn't thirst. In fact, I experienced an extraordinary sense of peace. My body was warm as if I had only just fed, and it was pleasant to lie there, to dream waking dreams on the gentle undulation of the sea. Then my mind began to clear. I knew that we were slipping very fast through rather still waters, and that the sun had just gone down. The early evening sky was darkening, the wind was dying away, and the sound of the oars dipping and rising was as soothing as it was clear. My eyes were now open. I was no longer in the coffin. I had just come out of the rear cabin of the long vessel, and I was standing on the deck. I breathed the fresh, salt air, and I saw the lovely, incandescent blue of the twilight sky and the multitude of brilliant stars overhead. Never from land do the stars look like that. Never are they so near. There were dark, mountainous islands on either side of us, cliffs sprinkled with tiny flickering lights. The air was full of the scent of green things, of flowers, of land itself. And a small, sleek vessel was moving fast to a narrow pass through the cliffs ahead. I felt uncommonly clear-headed and strong. There was a moment's temptation to try to figure out how I had gotten here, whether I was in the Aegean or the Mediterranean itself, to know when we had left Cairo, and if the things I remembered had really taken place. But this slipped away from me in some quiet acceptance of what was happening. Marius was up ahead on the bridge, before the main mast. I walked towards the bridge and stood beside it, looking up. He was wearing the long red velvet cloak he had worn in Cairo, and his full white blonde hair was blown back by the wind. His eyes were fixed on the pass before us, the dangerous rocks that protruded from the shallow water, his left hand gripping the rail of the little deck. I felt an overpowering attraction to him, and the sense of peace in me expanded. There was no forbidding grandeur to his face or his stance, no loftiness that might have humbled me and made me afraid. There was only a quiet nobility about him, his eyes rather wide as they looked forward, the mouth suggesting a disposition of exceptional gentleness as before. Too smooth the face, yes. It had the sheen of scar tissue, it was so smooth, and it might have startled, even frightened, in a dark street. It gave off a faint light, but the expression was too warm, too human in its goodness to do anything but invite. Armand might have looked like a god out of Caravaggio, Gabriel, a marble archangel at the threshold of a church. But this figure above me was that of an immortal man. And the immortal man, with his right hand outstretched before him, was silently but unmistakably piloting the ship through the rocks before the pass. The waters around us shimmered like molten metal, flashing azure, then silver, then black. They sent up a great white froth as the shallow waves beat upon the rocks. I drew closer, and as quietly as I could I climbed the small steps to the bridge. Marius didn't take his eyes off the waters for an instant, but he reached out with his left hand and took my hand, which was at my side. Warmth. Unobtrusive pressure. But this wasn't the moment for speaking, and I was surprised that he had acknowledged me at all. His eyebrows came together, and his eyes narrowed slightly, and, as if impelled by his silent command, the oarsmen slowed their stroke. I was fascinated by what I was watching, and I realized, as I deepened my own concentration, that I could feel the power emanating from him, a low pulse that came in time with his heart. I could also hear mortals on the surrounding cliffs, and on the narrow island beaches stretching out to our right and to our left. I saw them gathered on the promontories, or running towards the edge of the water with torches in their hands. I could hear thoughts ringing out like voices from them as they stood in the thin evening darkness looking out to the lanterns of our ship. The language was Greek and not known to me, but the message was clear. The Lord is passing. Come down and look. The Lord is passing. And the word Lord incorporated in some vague way the supernatural in its meaning. And a reverence, mingled with excitement, emanated like a chorus of overlapping whispers from the shores. I was breathless, listening to this. I thought of the mortal I'd terrified in Cairo, the old debacle on Renault's stage. But for those two humiliating incidents, I'd passed through the world invisibly for 10 years. And these people, these dark-clad peasants, gathered to watch the passing of the ship, knew what Marius was. Or at least they knew something of what he was. They were not saying the Greek word for vampire, which I had come to understand. But we were leaving the beaches behind. The cliffs were closing on either side of us. The ship glided with its oars above water. The high walls diminished the sky's light. In a few moments, I saw a great silver bay opening before us, and a sheer wall of rock rising straight ahead, while gentler slopes enclosed the water on either side. The rock face was so high and so steep that I could make out nothing at the top. The oarsmen cut their speed as we came closer. The boat was turning ever so slightly to the side, and as we drifted on towards the cliff, I saw the dim shape of an old stone embankment covered with gleaming moss. The oarsmen had lifted their oars straight towards the sky. Marius was as still as ever, his hand exerting a gentle force on mine, as with the other he pointed towards the embankment and the cliff that rose like the night itself, our lanterns sending up their glare on the wet rock. When we were no more than 5 or 6 feet from the embankment, dangerously close for a ship of this size and weight, it seemed, I felt the ship stop. Then Marius took my hand, and we went across the deck together, and mounted the side of the ship. A dark-haired servant approached, and placed a sack in Marius's hand. And together, Marius and I leapt over the water to the stone embankment, easily clearing the distance without a sound. I glanced back to see the ship rocking slightly. The oars were being lowered again. Within seconds the ship was heading for the distant lights of a tiny town on the far side of the bay. Marius and I stood alone in the darkness, and when the ship had become only a dark speck on the glimmering water, he pointed to a narrow stairway cut into the rock. "Go before me, Lestat," he said. It felt good to be climbing. It felt good to be moving up swiftly, following the rough-cut steps and the zigzag turns, and feeling the wind get stronger, and seeing the water become ever more distant and frozen, as if the movement of the waves had been stopped. Marius was only a few steps behind me, and again I could feel and hear that pulse of power. It was like a vibration in my bones. The rough-cut steps disappeared less than halfway up the cliff, and I was soon following a path not wide enough for a mountain goat. Now and then boulders or outcroppings of stone made a margin between us and a possible fall to the water below. But most of the time the path itself was the only outcropping on the cliff face, and as we went higher and higher, even I became afraid to look down. Once, with my hand around a tree branch, I looked back and saw Marius moving steadily towards me, the bag slung over his shoulder, his right hand hanging free. The bay, the distant little town and the harbour, all this appeared toy-like. A map made by a child on a tabletop with a mirror and sand and tiny bits of wood. I could even see beyond the pass into the open water, and the deep, shadowy shapes of other islands rising out of the motionless sea. Marius smiled and waited. Then he whispered very politely, "Go on." I must have been spellbound. I started up again and didn't stop until I reached the summit. I crawled over a last jut of rocks and weeds and climbed to my feet in soft grass. Higher rocks and cliffs lay ahead, and seeming to grow out of them was an immense fortress of a house. There were lights in its windows, lights on its towers. Marius put his arm around my shoulder and we went towards the entrance. I felt his grip loosen on me as he paused in front of the massive door. Then came the sound of a bolt, sliding back inside. The door swung open, and his grip became firm again. He guided me into the hallway where a pair of torches provided an ample light. I saw, with a little shock, that there was no one there who could have moved the bolt or opened the door for us. He turned and he looked at the door, and the door closed. "Slide the bolt," he said. I wondered why he didn't do it the way he had done everything else, but I put it in place immediately as he asked. "It's easier that way, by far," he said, and a little mischief came into his expression. "I'll show you to the room where you may sleep safely, and you may come to me when you wish." I could hear no one else in the house, but mortals had been there, that I could tell. They'd left their scent here and there, and the torches had all been lighted only a short time ago. We went up a little stairway to the right, and when I came out into the room that was to be mine, I was stunned. It was a huge chamber, with one entire wall open to a stone-railed terrace that hung over the sea. When I turned around, Marius was gone. The sack was gone. But Nicky's violin and my valise of belongings lay on a stone table in the middle of the room. A current of sadness and relief passed through me at the sight of the violin. I had been afraid that I had lost it. There were stone benches in the room, a lighted oil lamp on a stand, and in a far niche was a pair of heavy wooden doors. I went to these and opened them and found a little passage which turned sharply in an L. Beyond the bend was a sarcophagus with a plain lid. It had been cleanly fashioned out of diorite, which to my knowledge is one of the hardest stones on earth. The lid was immensely heavy, and when I examined the inside of it, I saw that it was plated in iron and contained a bolt that could be slipped from within. Several glittering objects lay on the bottom of the box itself. As I lifted them, they sparkled almost magically in the light that leaked in from the room. There was a golden mask, its features carefully moulded, the lips closed, the eye-holes narrow but open, attached to a hood made up of layered plates of hammered gold. The mask itself was heavy, but the hood was very light and very flexible, each little plate strung to the others by gold thread. And there was also a pair of leather gloves covered completely in tinier, more delicate gold plates like scales. And finally, a large folded blanket of the softest red wool with one side sewn with larger gold plates. I realized that if I put on this mask and these gloves, if I laid over me the blanket, then I would be protected from the light if anyone opened the lid of the sarcophagus while I slept. But it wasn't likely that anyone could get into the sarcophagus. and the doors of this L-shaped chamber were also covered with iron, and they too had their iron bolt. Yet there was a charm to these mysterious objects. I liked to touch them, and I pictured myself wearing them as I slept. The mask reminded me of the Greek masks of comedy and tragedy. All of these things suggested the burial of an ancient king. I left these things a little reluctantly. I came back out into the room, took off the garments I'd worn during my nights in the earth in Cairo, and put on fresh clothes. I felt rather absurd standing in this timeless place, in a violet-blue frock coat with pearl buttons, and the usual lace shirt and diamond buckle satin shoes, but these were the only clothes I had. I tied back my hair in a black ribbon like any proper 18th-century gentleman, and went in search of the master of the house. 2. Torches had been lighted throughout the house. Doors lay open. Windows were uncovered as they looked out over the firmament and the sea. And as I left the barren little stairs that led down from my room, I realized that for the first time in my wandering, I was truly in the safe refuge of an immortal being, furnished and stocked with all the things that an immortal being might want. Magnificent Grecian urns stood on pedestals in the corridors. Great bronze statues from the Orient in their various niches. Exquisite plants bloomed at every window and terrace open to the sky. Gorgeous rugs from India, Persia, China covered the marble floors wherever I walked. I came upon giant stuffed beasts mounted in lifelike attitudes, the brown bear, the lion, the tiger, even the elephant standing in his own immense chamber. Lizards as big as dragons, birds of prey clutching dried branches made to look like the limbs of real trees. But the brilliantly colored murals covering every surface from floor to ceiling dominated all. In one chamber was a dark, vibrant painting of the sunburnt Arabian desert, complete with an exquisitely detailed caravan of camels and turbaned merchants moving over the sand. In another room, a jungle came to life around me, swarming with delicately rendered tropical blossoms, vines, carefully drawn leaves. The perfection of the illusion startled me, enticed me, but the more I peered into the pictures, the more I saw. There were creatures everywhere in the texture of the jungle, insects, birds, worms in the soil. A million aspects of the scene that gave me the feeling, finally, that I had slipped out of time and space into something that was more than a painting. Yet it was all quite flat upon the wall. I was getting dizzy. Everywhere I turned, walls gave out on new vistas. I couldn't name some of the tints and hues I saw. As for the style of all this painting, it baffled me as much as it delighted me. The technique seemed utterly realistic, using the classical proportions and skills that one sees in all the later Renaissance painters, Da Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo, as well as the painters of more recent times, Watteau, Fragonard. The use of light was spectacular. Living creatures seemed to breathe as I looked on. But the details couldn't have been realistic or in proportion. There were simply too many monkeys in the jungle, too many bugs crawling on the leaves. There were thousands of tiny insects in one painting of a summer sky. I came into a large gallery, walled on either side by painted men and women staring at me, and I almost cried out. Figures from all ages these were, Bedouins, Egyptians, then Greeks and Romans, and knights in armor, and peasants, and kings, and queens. There were Renaissance people in doublets and leggings, the Sun King with his massive mane of curls, and finally the people of our own age. But again, the details made me feel as if I were imagining them, the droplets of water clinging to a cape, the cut on the side of a face, the spider half crushed beneath a polished leather boot. I started to laugh. It wasn't funny. It was just delightful. I began to laugh and laugh. I had to force myself out of this gallery, and the only thing that gave me the willpower was the sight of a library, blazing with light. Walls and walls of books, and rolled manuscripts, giant glistening world globes in their wooden cradles, busts of the ancient Greek gods and goddesses, great sprawling maps. Newspapers in all languages lay in stacks on tables, and there were strewn everywhere curious objects, fossils, mummified hands, exotic shells. There were bouquets of dried flowers, figurines and fragments of old sculpture, alabaster jars covered with Egyptian hieroglyphs. And everywhere in the center of the room, scattered among the tables and the glass cases, were comfortable chairs with footstools and candelabra or oil lamps. In fact, the impression was one of comfortable messiness, of great long hours of pure enjoyment, of a place that was human in the extreme, human knowledge, human artifacts, chairs in which humans might sit. I stayed a long time here, perusing the Latin and Greek titles. I felt a little drunk, as if I'd happened on a mortal with a lot of wine in his blood. But I had to find Marius. I went on out of this room, down a little stairs, and through another painted hallway to an even larger room that was also full of light. I heard the singing of the birds and smelled the perfume of the flowers before I even reached this place. And then I found myself lost in a forest of cages. There were not only birds of all sizes and colors here, there were monkeys and baboons, all of them gone wild in their little prisons as I made my way around the room. Potted plants crowded against the cages, ferns and banana trees, cabbage roses, moonflower, jasmine, and other sweetly fragrant nighttime vines. There were purple and white orchids, waxed flowers that trapped insects in their maw, little trees groaning with peaches and lemons and pears. When I finally emerged from this little paradise, it was into a hall of sculptures equal to any gallery in the Vatican Museum. And I glimpsed adjoining chambers full of paintings, oriental furnishings, mechanical toys. Of course, I was no longer lingering on each object or new discovery. To learn the contents of this house would have taken a lifetime, and I pressed on. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew that I was being allowed to see all these things. Finally, I heard the unmistakable sound of Marius. That low, rhythmic beat of the heart which I had heard in Cairo, and I moved toward it. 3. I came into a brilliantly illuminated 18th-century salon. The stone walls had been covered in fine rosewood panelling, with framed mirrors rising to the ceiling. There were the usual painted chests, upholstered chairs, dark and lush landscapes, porcelain clocks, a small collection of books in the glass-doored bookcases, a newspaper of recent date lying on a small table beside a brocaded winged chair. High, narrow French doors opened onto the stone terrace, where banks of white lilies and red roses gave off their powerful perfume. And there, with his back to me, at the stone railing, stood an 18th-century man. It was Marius when he turned around and gestured for me to come out. He was dressed as I was dressed. The frock coat was red, not violet, the lace Valenciennes, not Bruxelles. But he wore very much the same costume, his shining hair tied back loosely in a dark ribbon just as mine was, and he looked not at all ethereal as Armand might have, but rather like a super-presence, a creature of impossible whiteness and perfection, who was nevertheless connected to everything around him, the clothes he wore, the stone railing on which he laid his hand, even the moment itself in which a small cloud passed over the bright half-moon. I savored the moment. That he and I were about to speak, that I was really here. I was still clear-headed as I had been on the ship. I couldn't feel thirst, and I sensed that it was his blood in me that was sustaining me. All the old mysteries collected in me, arousing me and sharpening me. Did those who must be kept lie somewhere on this island? Would all these things be known? I went up to the railing and stood beside him, glancing out over the sea. His eyes were now fixed on an island not a half mile off the shore below. he was listening to something that I could not hear. And the side of his face, in the light from the open doors behind us, looked too frighteningly like stone. But immediately he turned to me with a cheerful expression, the smooth face vitalized impossibly for an instant, and then he put his arm around me and guided me back into the room. He walked with the same rhythm as a mortal man, the step light but firm, the body moving through space in the predictable way. He led me to a pair of winged chairs that faced each other, and there we sat down. This was more or less the center of the room. The terrace was to my right, and we had a clear illumination from the chandelier above, as well as a dozen or so candelabra and sconces on the panelled walls. Natural, civilized it all was, and Marius settled in obvious comfort on the brocade cushions, and let his fingers curl around the arms of the chair. As he smiled, he looked entirely human. All the lines, the animation were there until the smile melted again. I tried not to stare at him, but I couldn't help it. And something mischievous crept into his face. My heart was skipping.
"What would be easier for you," he asked in French, "that I tell you why I brought you here? Or that you tell me why you asked to see me?"
"Oh, the former would be easier," I said. "You talk." He laughed in a soft, ingratiating fashion.
"You're a remarkable creature," he said. "I didn't expect you to go down into the earth so soon. Most of us experience the first death much later, after a century, maybe even two."
"The first death? You mean it's common to go into the earth the way I did?"
"Among those who survive, it's common. We die. We rise again. Those who don't go into the earth for periods of time usually do not last."
I was amazed, but it made perfect sense, and the awful thought struck me that if only Nicky had gone down into the earth instead of into the fire. But I couldn't think of Nicky now. I would start asking inane questions if I did. Is Nicky somewhere? Has Nicky stopped? Are my brothers somewhere? Have they simply stopped?
"But I shouldn't have been so surprised that it happened when it did in your case," he resumed, as if he hadn't heard these thoughts, or didn't want to address them just yet. "You've lost too much that was precious to you. You saw and learned a great deal very fast."
"How do you know what's been happening to me?" I asked. Again he smiled. He almost laughed. It was astonishing, the warmth emanating from him, the immediacy. The manner of his speech was lively and absolutely current. That is, he spoke like a well-educated Frenchman.
"I don't frighten you, do I?" he asked.
"I didn't think that you were trying to," I said.
"I'm not." He made an offhand gesture. "But your self-possession is a little surprising, nevertheless. But to answer your question, I know things that happen to our kind all over the world. And frankly, I do not always understand how or why I know. The power increases with age, as do all our powers. But it remains inconsistent, not easily controlled. There are moments when I can hear what is happening with our kind in Rome, or even in Paris. And when another calls to me as you have done, I can hear the call over amazing distances. I can find the source of it, as you have seen for yourself. But information comes to me in other ways as well. I know of the messages you left for me on walls throughout Europe because I read them. And I've often heard of you from others. And sometimes you and I have been near to each other, nearer than you ever supposed, and I have heard your thoughts.
I can hear your thoughts now, of course, as I'm sure you realize,
but I prefer to communicate with words."
"Why?" I asked. "I thought the older ones would dispense with speech altogether."
"Thoughts are imprecise," he said. "If I open my mind to you, I cannot really control what you read there. And when I read your mind, it is possible for me to misunderstand what I hear or see. I prefer to use speech and let my mental faculties work with it. I like the alarm of sound to announce my important communications, for my voice to be received. I do not like to penetrate the thoughts of another without warning, and quite frankly, I think speech is the greatest gift mortals and immortals share. I didn't know what to answer to this. Again, it made perfect sense, yet I found myself shaking my head. "And your manner," I said. "You don't move the way Armand or Magnus moved, the way I thought the ancient ones..."
"You mean like a phantom?" "Why should I?" he laughed again, softly, charming me.
He slumped back in the chair a little further and raised his knee, resting his foot on the seat cushion just as a man might in his private study.
"There were times, of course," he said, "when all of that was very interesting. To glide without seeming to take steps. To assume physical positions that are uncomfortable or impossible for mortals. To fly short distances and land without a sound. To move objects by the mere wish to do so. But it can be crude, finally. Human gestures are elegant. There is wisdom in the flesh, in the way the human body does things. I like the sound of my foot touching the ground, the feel of objects in my fingers. Besides, to fly even short distances and to move things by sheer will alone is exhausting. I can do it when I have to, as you've seen, but it's much easier to use my hands to do things."
I was delighted by this and didn't try to hide it.
"A singer can shatter a glass with a proper high note," he said. "But the simplest way for anyone to break a glass is simply to drop it on the floor."
I laughed outright this time. I was already getting used to the shifts in his face between mask-like perfection and expression and the steady vitality of his gaze that united both. The impression remained one of evenness and openness, of a startlingly beautiful and perceptive man. But what I could not get used to was the sense of presence, that something immensely powerful, dangerously powerful, was so contained and immediately there. I became a little agitated suddenly, a little overwhelmed. I felt the unaccountable desire to weep. He leaned forward and touched the back of my hand with his fingers, and a shock coursed through me. We were connected in the touch. And though his skin was silky, like the skin of all vampires, it was less pliant. It was like being touched by a stone hand in a silk glove.
"I brought you here because I want to tell you what I know," he said. "I want to share with you whatever secrets I possess. For several reasons, you have attracted me."
I was fascinated, and I felt the possibility of an overpowering love.
"But I warn you," he said, "there's a danger in this. I don't possess the ultimate answers. I can't tell you who made the world, or why man exists. I can't tell you why we exist. I can only tell you more about us than anyone else has told you so far. I can show you those who must be kept, and tell you what I know of them. I can tell you why I think I have managed to survive for so long. This knowledge may change you somewhat. That's all knowledge ever really does, I suppose."
"Yes,
but when I've given all I have to give, you will be exactly where you were before. An immortal being who must find his own reasons to exist."
"Yes," I said. "Reasons to exist." My voice was a little bitter, but it was good to hear it spelled out that way. But I felt a dark sense of myself as a hungry, vicious creature who did a very good job of existing without reasons, a powerful vampire who always took exactly what he wanted, no matter who said what. I wondered if he knew how perfectly awful I was. The reason to kill was the blood. Acknowledged. The blood and the sheer ecstasy of the blood, and without it we are husks, as I was in the Egyptian earth.
"Just remember my warning," he said, "that the circumstances will be the same afterwards. Only you might be changed. You might be more bereft than before you came here."
"But why have you chosen to reveal things to me?" I asked. Surely others have gone looking for you. You must know where Armand is.
There are several reasons, as I told you, he said. And probably the strongest reason is the manner in which you sought me. Very few beings really seek knowledge in this world. Mortal or immortal, few really ask. On the contrary, they try to wring from the unknown the answers they have already shaped in their own minds, justifications, confirmations, forms of consolation without which they can't go on. To really ask is to open the door to the whirlwind. The answer may annihilate the question and the questioner. But you have been truly asking since you left Paris 10 years ago.
I understood this, but only inarticulately.
You have few preconceptions, he said. In fact, you astound me because you admit to such extraordinary simplicity. You want a purpose. You want love.
True, I said with a little shrug. Rather crude, isn't it? He gave another soft laugh.
No, not really. It's as if 1800 years of Western civilization have produced an innocent.
An innocent?
You can't be speaking of me. There is so much talk in this century of the nobility of the savage, he explained, of the corrupting force of civilization, of the way we must find our way back to the innocence that has been lost. Well, it's all nonsense, really. Truly primitive people can be monstrous in their assumptions and expectations. They cannot conceive of innocence. Neither can children. But civilization has at last created men who behave innocently. For the first time they look about themselves and say, "What the hell is all this?"
True, but I'm not innocent, I said. Godless, yes, I come from godless people and I'm glad of it. But I know what good and evil are in a very practical sense, and I am Typhon, the slayer of his brother, not the killer of Typhon, as you must know.
He nodded with a slight lift of his eyebrows. He did not have to smile any more to look human. I was seeing an expression of emotion now, even when there were no lines whatsoever in his face. "But you don't seek any system to justify it either," he said. "That's what I mean by innocence. You're guilty of killing mortals because you've been made into something that feeds on blood and death. But you're not guilty of lying, of creating great dark and evil systems of thought within yourself."
True.
To be godless is probably the first step to innocence, he said. To lose the sense of sin and subordination, the false grief for things supposed to be lost.
So by innocence you mean not an absence of experience, but an absence of illusions?
An absence of need for illusions, he said. A love of and respect for what is right before your eyes.
I sighed. I sat back in the chair for the first time, thinking this over. What it had to do with Nicky, and what Nicky said about the light, always the light.
Had he meant this?
Marius seemed now to be pondering. He too was sitting back in his chair, as he had been all along, and he was looking off at the night sky beyond the open doors, his eyes narrow, his mouth a little tense.
"But it wasn't merely your spirit that attracted me," he said. "Your honesty, if you will. It was the way you came into being as one of us."
"Then you know all that, too?"
"Yes, everything," he said, dismissing that. "You have come into being at the end of an era, at a time when the world faces changes undreamed of. And it was the same with me. I was born and grew to manhood in a time when the ancient world, as we call it now, was coming to a close. Old faiths were worn out. A new god was about to rise."
"When was this time?" I asked excitedly.
"In the years of Augustus Caesar, when Rome had just become an empire, when faith in the gods was, for all lofty purposes, dead."
I let him see the shock and the pleasure spread over my face. I never doubted him for a moment. I put my hand to my head as if I had to steady myself a little. But he went on.
"The common people of those days," he said,
still believed in religion just as they do now. And for them it was custom, superstition, elemental magic, the use of ceremonies whose origins were lost in antiquity, just as it is today. But the world of those who originated ideas, those who ruled and advanced the course of history, was a godless and hopelessly sophisticated world like that of Europe in this day and age. When I read Cicero and Ovid and Lucretius, it seemed so to me, I said. He nodded and gave a little shrug.
It has taken 1800 years, he said, to come back to the skepticism, the level of practicality that was our daily frame of mind then. But history is by no means repeating itself. That is the amazing thing.
How do you mean?
Look around you. Completely new things are happening in Europe. The value placed on human life is higher than ever before. Wisdom and philosophy are coupled with new discoveries in science, new inventions which will completely alter the manner in which humans live. But that is a story unto itself. That is the future. The point is that you were born on the cusp of the old way of seeing things. And so was I. You came of age without faith, and yet you aren't cynical. And so it was with me. We sprang up from a crack between faith and despair, as it were.
And Nicky fell into that crack and perished, I thought.
That's why your questions are different, he said, from those who were born to immortality under the Christian God.
I thought of my conversation with Gabrielle in Cairo, my last conversation. I myself had told her this was my strength.
Precisely, he said. So you and I have that in common. We did not grow to manhood expecting very much of others, and the burden of conscience was private, terrible though it might be.
But was it under the Christian God, in the very first days of the Christian God, that you were born to immortality, as you said?
No, he said with a hint of disgust. We never served the Christian God. That you can put out of your mind right now.
But the forces of good and evil, behind the names of Christ and Satan.
Again, they have very little, if anything, to do with us.
But the concept of evil in some form, surely.
No. We are older than that, Lestat. The men that made me were worshippers of gods, true, and they believed in things that I did not believe. But their faith hearkened back to a time long before the temples of the Roman Empire, when the shedding of innocent human blood could be done on a massive scale in the name of good, and evil was the drought and the plague of the locust and the death of the crops. I was made what I am by these men in the name of good.
This was too enticing, too enthralling. All the old myths came to my mind in a chorus of dazzling poetry. Osiris was a good god to the Egyptians, a god of the corn. What has this to do with us? My thoughts were spinning. In a flash of mute pictures, I recalled the night I left my father's house in the Auvergne, when the villagers had been dancing round the Lenten fire and making their chants for the increase of the crops. Pagan, my mother had said. Pagan had declared the angry priest they had long ago sent away. And it all seemed more than ever the story of the savage garden, dancers in the savage garden, where no law prevailed except the law of the garden, which was the aesthetic law. That the crops shall grow high, that the wheat shall be green and then yellow, that the sun shall shine. Look at the perfectly shaped apple that the tree has made. Fancy that! The villagers would run through the orchards with their burning brands from the Lenten bonfire to make the apples grow.
Yes, the savage garden, Marius said with a spark of light in his eyes, and I had to go out of the civilized cities of the empire to find it. I had to go into the deep woods of the northern provinces, where the garden still grew at its lushest, the very land of southern Gaul in which you were born. I had to fall into the hands of the barbarians, who gave us both our stature, our blue eyes, our fair hair. I had it through the blood of my mother, who had come from those people, the daughter of a Celtic chieftain married to a Roman patrician.
and you have it through the blood of your fathers directly from those days. And by a strange coincidence, we were both chosen for immortality for the very same reason, you by Magnus and I by my captors, that we were the nonpareils of our blood and blue-eyed race, that we were taller and more finely made than other men.
Oh, you have to tell me all of it. You have to explain everything, I said.
I am explaining everything, he said. But first, I think it is time for you to see something that will be very important as we go on. He waited for a moment for the words to sink in. Then he rose slowly in human fashion, assisting himself easily with his hands on the arms of the chair. He stood looking down at me and waiting.
"Those who must be kept?" I asked.
My voice had gotten terribly small, terribly unsure of itself, and I could see a little mischief again in his face, or rather a touch of the amusement that was never far away.
"Don't be afraid," he said soberly, trying to conceal the amusement. "It's very unlike you, you know."
I was burning to see them, to know what they were, and yet I didn't move. I'd really thought that I would see them. I'd never really thought what it would mean.
Is it something terrible to see?" I asked.
He smiled slowly and affectionately and placed his hand on my shoulder.
"Would it stop you if I said yes?"
"No," I said, "but I was afraid."
"It's only terrible as time goes on," he said. "In the beginning, it's beautiful."
He waited, watching me, trying to be patient. Then he said softly,
"Come, let's go."
4. A stairway into the earth. It was much older than the house, this stairway, though how I knew I couldn't say. Steps, worn, concave in the middle from the feet that have followed them, winding deeper and deeper down into the rock. Now and then a rough-cut portal to the sea, an opening too small for a man to climb through, and a shelf upon which birds have nested, or where the wild grass grew out of the cracks. And then the chill. The inexplicable chill that you find sometimes in old monasteries, ruined churches, haunted rooms. I stopped and rubbed the backs of my arms with my hands. The chill was rising through the steps.
"They don't cause it," he said gently.
He was waiting for me on the steps just below. The semi-darkness broke his face into kindly patterns of light and shadow, gave the illusion of mortal age that wasn't there.
"It was here long before I brought them," he said. "Many have come to worship on this island. Maybe it was there before they came too."
He beckoned to me again with his characteristic patience. His eyes were compassionate.
"Don't be afraid," he said again as he stared down.
I was ashamed not to follow. The steps went on and on. We came on larger portals and the noise of the sea. I could feel the cool spray on my hands and face, see the gleam of the damp on the stones. But we went on down, farther and farther, the echo of our shoes swelling against the rounded ceiling, the rudely finished walls. This was deeper than any dungeon. This was the pit you dig in childhood when you brag to your mother and father that you will make a tunnel to the very center of the earth. Finally, I saw a burst of light as we rounded another bend, and at last two lamps burning before a pair of doors. Deep vessels of oil fed the wicks of the lamps, and the doors themselves were bolted by an enormous beam of oak. It would have taken several men to lift it, possibly levers, ropes. Marius lifted this beam and laid it aside easily, and then he stood back and looked at the doors. I heard the sound of another beam being moved on the inside. Then the doors opened slowly, and I felt my breathing come to a halt. It wasn't only that he'd done it without touching them. I had seen that little trick before. It was that the room beyond was full of the same lovely flowers and lighted lamps that I had seen in the house above. Here, deep underground, were lilies, waxen and white, and sparkling with droplets of moisture, roses in rich hues of red and pink, ready to fall from their vines. It was a chapel, this chamber, with a soft flicker of votive candles and the perfume of a thousand bouquets. The walls were painted in fresco, like the walls of ancient Italian churches, with gold leaf hammered into the design, but these were not pictures of Christian saints. Egyptian palm trees, the yellow desert, the three pyramids, the blue waters of the Nile, and the Egyptian men and women in their gracefully shaped boats sailing the river, the multicolored fishes of the deep beneath them, the purple-winged birds of the air above. And the gold worked into it all, into the sun that shone from the heavens, and the pyramids that gleamed in the distance, into the scales of the fishes and the feathers of the birds, and the ornaments of the lithe and delicate Egyptian figures who stood frozen looking forward in their long, narrow green boats. I closed my eyes for a moment. I opened them slowly and saw the whole like a great shrine. Banks of lilies on a low stone altar, which held an immense golden tabernacle, worked all over with fine engraving of the same Egyptian designs, and the air coming down through deep shafts in the rock above, stirring the flames of the ever-burning lamps, ruffling the tall green blade-like leaves of the lilies as they stood in their vessels of water giving off their heady perfume. I could almost hear hymns in this place. I could hear chants and ancient invocations, and I was no longer afraid. The beauty was too soothing, too grand. But I stared at the gold doors of the tabernacle on the altar. The tabernacle was taller than I was. It was broader by 3 times. But Marius, too, was looking at it. And I felt the power moving out of him, the low heat of his invisible strength, and I heard the inside lock of the tabernacle doors slide back. I would have moved just a little closer to him had I dared. I wasn't breathing as the gold doors opened completely, folding back to reveal 2 splendid Egyptian figures, a man and a woman, seated side by side. The light moved over their slender, finely sculpted white faces, their decorously arranged white limbs. It flashed in their dark eyes. They were as severe as all the Egyptian statues I had ever seen, spare of detail, beautiful in contour, magnificent in their simplicity, only the open and childlike expression on the faces relieving the feeling of hardness and cold. But unlike all the others, they were dressed in real fabric and real hair. I had seen saints in Italian churches dressed in this manner, velvet hung on marble, and it was not always pleasing, but this had been done with great care. Their wigs were of long, thick, black locks, cut straight across the forehead and crowned with circlets of gold. Round their naked arms were bracelets like snakes, and on their fingers were rings. The clothes were the finest white linen, the man naked to the waist and wearing only a skirt of sorts, and the woman in a long, narrow, beautifully pleated dress. Both wore many gold necklaces, some inlaid with precious stones. Almost the same size they were, and they sat in the very same manner, hands laid flat before them on their thighs, and this sameness astonished me somehow, as much as their stark loveliness and the jewel-like quality of their eyes. Not in any sculpture anywhere had I ever seen such a lifelike attitude, but actually there was nothing lifelike about them at all. Maybe it was a trick of the accoutrement, the twinkling of the lights on their necklaces and rings, the reflected light in their gleaming eyes. Were they Osiris and Isis? Was it tiny writing I saw on their necklaces, on the circlets of their hair? Marius said nothing. He was merely gazing at them as I was, his expression unreadable, perhaps sad. "May I go near them?" I whispered.
"Of course," he said.
I moved towards the altar like a child in a cathedral, getting ever more tentative with each step. I stopped only a few feet before them, and looked directly into their eyes. Oh, too gorgeous in depth and variegation, too real. With infinite care, each black eyelash had been fixed. Each